such a nice thing to have. And I think I struggled when I went to the US with, problems with race. And I know our international school was sort of a utopia, you know, in that sense. Like, I feel there weren't too many issues, at least in the girls' school. We really, like, by the time we were in high school, we really, like, respected each other, and we really, like, loved our differences, you know, and just being able to, live in that way, I think. Being able to celebrate our uniqueness while feeling connected as one human, like the same human race, is just like, it's just a really nice way to be able to live your life. Especially in contrast with all the, you know, problems that we're seeing in the rest of the world. So yeah, just being able to give that base, I think, for a child is really special.
Well, welcome to episode 77 of Tokyo Alumni Podcast. Today, our guest is a design research director at IDEO Tokyo. She brings more than 20 years of experience leading creative projects of all sizes. At IDEO, she has worked on projects such as redesigning medical products for the elderly, new beauty experiences for millennials, and systemic redesigns for our culture. Previously, she worked as a strategic planner at marketing agency, working on CRM, or campaign for global companies such as Nissan, Microsoft, and P&G. She graduated from the University of Michigan, where she created her own degree in international relations. She has also engaged in professional development programs from Stanford and Harvard in advanced project management, disruptive strategy, and most recently completed courses in leading the sustainability transformation and design for sustainability. Her current passion is in adding life-centered principles to a human-centered approach. She's excited to lend her expertise and innovation to help businesses be more regenerative by design for the next decade. Welcome to the podcast, Amelia.
Thank you.
So I just want to hear from you first. I know there was that introduction, but maybe in your own words, for less than a minute, can you tell the audience what you do?
Yeah. So my company, IDEO, we work with clients and we help them when they want to innovate on new services, new products. And so my job as a design researcher, I used to work on projects as part of a multidisciplinary team. So, if a client comes to us with a question like, what's the future of automobiles or what's the future of the kitchen? It would be my job as a researcher to then think about, okay, well, where are we going to get inspiration to find new values? Who do we talk to? What kind of extreme of, you know, behaviors do we observe? What kind of experiences do we go do ourselves so that we can, you know, inspire the team to come up with new ideas? And so that was the role of the design researcher.
So with this design research position, you started your career at Dentsu. So is that sort of a common trajectory to get to what you're doing now? Or did you go sort of a less common route?
Yeah, I don't think the role of design researcher is very well known, and maybe more so in Japan. Even when I started, I knew what a design researcher did. You know, coming out of college, I knew I wasn't the financial type. I know a lot of, our bilingual alumni get, scouted, I guess, into that industry. And I just knew that I could not do finance. And I knew I needed to be part of a creative industry. And so, you know, I went into advertising, but I kind of had my qualms with that, knowing I didn't like the idea of, you know, blasting people with, you know, information when they weren't desiring it. So I did spend a lot of time I started in direct marketing, which also has a bad rap, but in my mind, it was the lesser of the evil because you were only providing, advertising information when people raised their hands. When people asked for it, then you were providing that information. So I kind of liked that aspect of advertising. And I did that for about, 10 years or longer, maybe 13 years. But as I was doing that, I met with some colleagues. They reminded me of IDEO and this, innovation consultancy. And they have a process called design thinking. And at that time, I thought, wow, I could really incorporate that process of design thinking into my, advertising or my role as a strategic planner at that time. I felt it was strange that I was, as a strategic planner, planning for campaigns without really just doing desktop research. I didn't, plan a hair care campaign or something, but I didn't really know, talk to end consumers or, they liked about hair care, what they were struggling with hair care. Without talking to anyone, I just kind of came up with, campaigns that we could run. And I just thought that process was, not the right way to go about doing things. So design thinking was more about, human-centered design, go and talk to the people, go, get firsthand knowledge in the field, observe them in their homes using these products, and then, coming up with kind of new services or new products. And I just really wanted to go upstream at that point. I think the biggest thing was, why am I advertising these products when I don't even believe in them? Can I go further upstream where I can actually influence how these products are being made or, brought into the market? And so I think that's why I started gravitating towards that direction. And by, I took an executive course in design thinking at Stanford. And then I came back and it was just, I think, the right timing. IDEO had opened an office in Tokyo. I was able to meet with some of the founders the ones who started the studio here in a workshop. And they were, it just happened that there were some ways I could get involved in the starting of the studio here. So
that's really intriguing how you mentioned, a lot of people do go to finance. Ironically, actually, the next guest is going to be a guy in finance, sure enough. So I feel like you are straddling, though, these two areas of both sort of being a creative, but also, clearly corporate. So do you feel like sort of that creative background, that idea of, you've written an article, for example, in Forbes Japan called Ningen Chushin no Innovation or Umidasu. So like, that idea of being innovative and original, is that something that was fostered early on when you were at international school, or is it something that developed later on in your career?
I don't know. Creativity. I do know what was fostered in the international school, which is another element of working at IDEO, which is teamwork. So I really, through my experience at Seisen, I played on the volleyball team. I was part of the a cappella group, the speech team, and those all required. And even in the speech, I was in the, anyways, it was always these like group activities that I really gravitated to, and you experience something that you can't achieve on your own by coming together. And that was true of volleyball, and a cappella. Right? It's not about standing out yourself. It's about kind of blending in with others and creating this beautiful harmony. And so I was always kind of drawn to that aspect of collaboration and working with others. And I knew coming out of college, like, I have to work in a team. I want to work in a collaborative team. And so as I was seeking that, I think once I got to, I didn't find that in a corporate setting, but once I got to IDEO, that is the way you work is, you work on 3-month projects and you're given a room and you sit with four, as a group of four designers, and you all come from different disciplines. So You know, mine was from research, you know, and my role was to really look at people and understand their motivations and what they desire and then how that translates into design. But another designer would be like, you know, an interaction designer, and his background is in coding and understanding human computer interfaces. Or another colleague would be from a communications designer. So their background and strength is either in copywriting or in graphic design. And then another one would be a business designer, and maybe their background is like an MBA or they've worked in startups. So, you know, this multidisciplinary team, we all have very different perspectives, very different approaches to how we solve problems, but we're looking at the same problem. And, you know, there might be tensions, but when we work through them, that's when we figure out this, you know, a completely new value that we that didn't exist before. And that is really addictive to work in that kind of environment. I think I was always seeking that. And yeah, I guess, it's a very creative act, but, you know, I don't think it was top of mind for me, like that I wanted, that I needed, the very common definition of being creative.
That's really interesting, you know, talking about multidisciplinary sort of, you know, fluency to be able to, you know, cross those different areas of discipline. But in regard to cross-cultural fluency, I feel like that's something, you know, us international school kids are quite adept at. Do you feel like Seisen prepared you for that type of experience? And I guess in your current, you know, occupation, I know you're working in Tokyo, which tends to be a bit more homogeneous than, let's say, New York or London. Do you still find teams being fairly culturally diverse?
Yes. Yeah, I think that's another characteristic of our IDEO studio in Tokyo, particularly. We, if you walk, I guess the common language we share is English. But, you know, obviously our major clients speak Japanese. The people that we're designing for are often in Japan. So, you know, we speak with participants who are Japanese. So we do need to go, you know, back and forth between the two languages. And then we are also, we also have a good balance as a studio when we're hiring of, and it's hard to measure, like it's not black and white, like, you know, maybe you like citizenship wise, you're from different countries, but everyone's sort of mixed in the sense that they've grown up in one place, but they, you know, they're culturally, they're from somewhere else, or, you know, even if they were born someplace, they grew up elsewhere. And so everyone's sort of mixed. But we do keep a balance of like native Japanese speakers versus, and then we have, you know, maybe half the studio that doesn't speak Japanese natively. And so I think that gives a really good balance of how we can offer value to our clients, right? We try to strike the right balance between being able to be considerate enough of requirements for, you know, being sensitive enough to what is required in the Japanese market, but at the same time, you know, being bold enough to suggest something beyond it. Or being able to have the perspective to see beyond what is necessary here. And so it's a really delicate balance. And I think, yeah, it's something we pay a lot of attention to in hiring.
Yeah. When it comes to language, you know, at your company, one thing I found really interesting was I read, so, you know, the article you wrote for Forbes Japan, and it was in Japanese, where I feel like most of the people I've interviewed on this podcast, a lot of their writing, at least stuff professionally, oh, English. So how were you able to, you know, as a Seisen grad who went to UMich, I think keeping that, right, Japanese, you know, competence, especially writing wise, is very difficult. So in your case, were there any specific strategies you used to sort of maintain a high level of, you know, Japanese writing and reading?
So, you know, I was one of those, my mother was a Japanese teacher.
Okay.
And she actually even taught at Seisen. And in the end, actually, she was my IB teacher, because she was really adamant about, you know, my graduating as a bilingual diploma holder. from the IB system. However, you know, despite my mom, she was so great at, you know, giving me those opportunities. I was so ungrateful. You know, when you're growing up, you're like, why do I need to learn Japanese? Why do I, you know, and my daughter's the same way right now. But, and then once you graduate and you try to look for a job, you're like, thank God. Thank you. Thank you for pushing me through. But, I was not perfect graduating high school in my Japanese. I don't think it was the level it needed. It was clearly not the same level as my English. My English suffered as well, right? Coming through international school. I think my language was kind of spread between English and Japanese, but I think going to the US and then continuing in my career, it allowed me to improve my English. And then while I was in college, I also I also took Chinese. And I was like, if I take Chinese, it'll give, you know, me an excuse to revisit my characters without embarrassing myself. So anyway, so that allowed me to kind of strengthen, you know, writing of kanji. But if I answer your question about how did I write the article, I have, you know, in our studio, we also have editors that help to bring it to the level in which it can be published. So, you know, I obviously wrote it to a certain level in Japanese, and then they help to take it up a notch. I still do need that kind of editing help, but I think, you know, what my mother offered was the ability to know what is good. Right. When you read it, you know, that's a good level of Japanese. So, you know, what to strive for, and you know what you're missing. And so, you know, where to get help, I think. But obviously, if you can get your, you know, Japanese and English to that same level, that would really be the best for our, you know, bilingual education in our international schools.
Yeah, it's funny how you mentioned there, you know, you didn't like that your mom pushed you. And I feel like a lot of us go through that, who, you know, are raised in bilingual households. And, you know, currently you're a mother yourself. And so how do you try to maintain more than one language in the household?
I don't think we're a great model. I think I swung the other way where I felt you know, because it was chuto hampa, right, between my English and Japanese growing up, I really wanted to give my daughter kind of a jiku, you know, a strong foundation in one language, which she can then expand to the next. So, yeah, we put a major emphasis on English. And so she's like, she's so good, but she's still really just trying to catch up in Japanese. And I feel terribly for her. It's a really hard one to balance. We started her out actually in hoikuen. So until the age of 5, her first language was Japanese, right? And she spoke to us in Japanese, which we were nervous until the age of 5, like if she was really going to pick up English to, you know, a high level. And in first grade, she started Seisen, and she struggled that first year. You know, she was behind in her, we hadn't really taught her beyond the alphabet. So she couldn't read 3-letter words. But we were reading so many English books to her that her love for books and learning just took off. And by the end of second grade, she had finished all the Harry Potter books. So yeah, that took off, I guess. So what we weren't doing was, I guess, supplementing her Japanese. And she tells us now, you know, we always say like, oh, your English took off because, you know, we had a rule. We said from the day you were born, we're going to read an English book to you every night. And so that worked. She says, you should have also read a Japanese book to us.
Yeah, that's a tough one. As you're saying, I think a lot of us fall in that sort of chuto hampa range, but it's also because it's so hard to be at that level. And yeah, that's really intriguing too. That so she was weaker in English, but now she's stronger in English. And
yes, and her Japanese actually, she's still doing. So the way it's being encouraged now is my husband. and daughter both take ECC junior Japanese lessons together because he knows that she wouldn't, you know, be being as motivated to do it alone. So every Saturday morning, that's their thing.
That's really cool. That it's sort of a life learning or lifelong, you know, that's probably you and I both experience with our own language. So you send your own children to Seisen. So obviously there's something that, you know, you believe in the international school system. So why should a parent send their child to an international school or specifically Seisen?
Oh, gosh. I guess I never really thought beyond like who should, like why should someone send it? I mean, it just feels like the right choice for myself and, you know, for Alex. Yeah, I mean, I just feel very grateful for the type of environment they provided. You know, you kind of, you're studying shoulder to shoulder with, you know, kids from completely different cultures and completely different values and backgrounds, and you just get to very close understanding of you never travel to those cultures, but you get a view into how they might think, and it's just ingrained in how you look at the world. Such a nice thing to have. And I think I struggled when I went to the US with, you know, problems with race. And I know our international school was sort of a utopia, you know, in that sense. Like, I feel there weren't too many issues, at least in the girls' school. We really, like, by the time we were in high school, we really, like, respected each other and we really, like, loved our differences, you know, and just being able to, live in that way. I think being able to celebrate our uniqueness while feeling connected as one human, like the same human race, is just like, it's just a really nice way to be able to live your life. Especially in contrast with all the, you know, problems that we're seeing in the rest of the world. So yeah, just being able to give that base, I think, for a child is really special.
To revisit a moment ago, you said you struggled in the United States. What do you mean by that? When you said like sort of racially, and I'm guessing identity wise, which a lot of us go through.
Yeah. I mean, there are so many things. I think growing up in Japan, my mother always told me, you're American. And I actually only have US citizenship. So that's true. And, you know, and always feeling different in Japan from others, I felt, okay, if I graduate and go to the US, I'm going to finally feel at home or finally feel like I belong somewhere. And then, you know, once I got there, obviously you have your your shock and you're like, oh, wow, I know I don't fit in this country. I didn't watch any of the, you know, TV shows or the movies that everyone here talks about. I'm, you know, unfamiliar with the types of foods that they, you know, like to eat, or just, yeah, everything. And there are just so many, so much conversation about race, which was just insolvable. There were so many things that just made me realize that I wasn't American, and I gave up actually, and came back to Japan, and just I don't fully fit in here either, but I guess it's comfortable living where you grew up. But I think when I finally felt like I came home was actually when I joined IDEO. And I think it's because of, we're culturally diverse, and also, That multidisciplinary aspect and collaboration is very close to cultural diversity. And the other one is like, we do take the time to celebrate our differences, but then kind of see our similarities in our approach and you know, our mission, I guess. it's a really hard thing for people to do, I think, but yeah, I think the core to like diversity and inclusion is, you know, being able to celebrate differences and but then see ourselves as one at the same time.
Yeah, I think you're definitely part of the big club where people go to the States and they don't feel like they belong. And obviously, I don't think any of us ever really belonged in Tokyo. I mean, I think by nature, just with the way you look, like if you're not, and even for my friends who did look Japanese, because maybe they're Japanese American or they're, you know, born and bred Japanese, because they went to Inta, they were kind of considered outside, right? They were never part of it. So that's actually really cool to hear just how diverse and great place IDEO is, because I feel like a lot of us like are still looking for that family, right? And maybe that's kind of the ethos of partly this podcast, even for me, because it's like, I don't belong anywhere. You know, I don't, where I live in Korea, where I clearly don't belong. And when I'm in Japan, I don't really belong there either. So this international community is sort of the only home that I have. But for you, you also have IDEO, so that's nice. So you return from UMich. I think very similar, actually, with a lot of us. You sort of long this life back in Japan. And what I was curious to talk to you about is, you know, you've been a professional either most of your career, all of your career in Japan, and I think it's difficult being a woman anywhere, but being in Japan. Right. It's like, I think another level of sort of a barrier and hurdles you have to get over. So what would your advice be towards, you know, younger people who maybe in college age or they just recently graduated? Like, how did you navigate those waters being a young professional woman in Japan?
I think it's changed a lot. So what would I say? I think in my generation, I didn't notice any friction until I became pregnant. I think that was the first moment I realized that there is a difference being a woman in an office. And you know, because, you know, people start treating you differently and they start looking at your value at work differently. And so I really had to kind of erase my image of myself as a mother. Like I did not want people associating me with motherhood. So I had to make sure I was, you know, delivering just as much. And like I could go on business trips. Of course I can, because I can, find someone, or my husband can step in, or any mention of motherhood, I would just be like, don't worry about it. It's taken care of. Oh, and, you know, I hired things like there was this byoji hoiku. So I was like, I am the one thing that stands out in terms of motherhood is like, if your child gets sick with a sudden fever and they're in hoiku and you need to like go pick them up. And it's just like, everyone notices when you do that, right? When you have to like leave the office. And so I was like, you know, I'm going to make sure I've hired that, byoji hoiku. So I never have to, you know, miss, like I always have that help, that insurance that if there's a sudden illness that will be, you know, cared for. But I guess my advice for the younger generation is that, like, don't do that anymore. Like, bring your whole self to work. And I think the environment has changed and people understand, and hiding it doesn't help move any of the conversation forward. I felt like I had to hide it to be part of the club and to, you know, be seen as someone that, like, deserved a career progression. But I think that's not the case anymore. And so, yeah, I'm hoping people's minds have changed enough to be able to, speak up about when they need to leave, and, you know, and we will work around it together. At least that's how we are doing it in IDEO. And I'm just hoping that is going to be the case for others going forward.
Do you think these positive, you know, changes are, when you say that, are you saying sort of in a more soft sense in regards to just sort of a cultural, social feeling, but, or are you also saying, like, have there been tangible, measurable changes that have also maybe changed these last 10, 15 years, especially in regards to childbearing and hoikuin type of, you know, I guess having toddlers?
Yeah, huge ones. I think, I mean, I remember when I was pregnant, I was interviewing with several big companies, and, they were happy to move me on to the, you know, next interview. But the second they found out I was pregnant, they, even like a major, major brand that you wouldn't associate with things like this, they would be like, then call us back once you have a child, or once I had a child, and I hadn't started working yet. This was like in my parental leave moment, you know, they were asking, as a new mom, how much can you commit to this job? Like, we work late hours. Mm-hmm. Like, can you show up to that? And I didn't know how to answer that. I haven't even proven to myself that I'd be able to work as a, you know, as a mother, So, I don't know. I feel like, but since then you see, you know, the people become like prime ministers and presidents while they're pregnant and have children. So, things have changed. And I think in terms of paternity leave as well, we have like, I think our, you know, benefits have changed, I guess, in terms of, you know, how long people can take off. And I think it's so important for fathers to have time to bond with their children. And that helps the mothers as well, right? It helps the family. And so, yeah, having that kind of, actual policies that help with that progress, that has also changed. There could be more, yeah, but it's going in the right direction.
Yeah, it's when I was, you know, asking that question too, I guess the ones I was kind of thinking about was, as you mentioned, paternity leave. I think that changes a big, in regards to dynamics too, of sort of the father versus mother, and, you know, what the social expectations are. As well as, you know, I think there's now, there's been a new law fairly recently where if there's a miscarriage, take time off, which, right, you know, surprisingly did not exist in a lot of countries until just this past decade. So it does feel like things are getting better. And before we move on to the last question, where I want to see what you're up to, one thing I thought is kind of fun that I've started doing in more recent episodes is, like, are there any, like, shout outs towards any specific teachers, administrators when you were at SASIN that has really, you know, helped form the person you are, you know, this achieved professional that you are today? Like, any few that will come to your mind?
Yeah, there's so many. But I think for me, a pivotal point was in second grade. My teacher, Miss McGrory, I think really helped me come out of my shell. So, I started out my life in the US and went to preschool there. And I was a child that really loved to sing and dance and kind of like express myself. And then at age 3 and a half, we moved to Japan and I found myself in a Japanese kindergarten, and it was a very like proper, you know, full uniform, like line up in a row every day and make sure your nails are cut and in your pockets, you always have a handkerchief and tissue. And if so, you get a sticker, and if not, no, and you must finish all your food before you can, you know, it's very strict. And I suddenly found myself in the complete opposite environment where I couldn't express myself at all. And I started having stomach aches every day. And my parents were like, oh, okay, we need to switch schools. And I think that's when they found Seisan. But I think I was so affected by that experience that in kindergarten at Seisan, and in first grade, I was really, really shy. And it was also a language thing because I went from English to Japan, and then I only spoke Japanese, completely forgot English, and then was thrown back into an English environment and, you know, was still trying to pick up English, I guess. And I felt clumsy and I felt like I was inadequate. And that was all through kindergarten and first grade. And then in second grade, I just loved to sing. And this teacher, Miss McCrory, she always had a guitar and she would just go around singing. And I loved it. I loved, you know, the music that she was bringing into the class. And I think she saw how my eyes would light up every time there was singing. And then, as second grade, we decided to put on a Christmas play. And there was no way, I like in my heart, I really wanted to be the star, the main character. But there was no way. I'm this shy kid. There's no way I'm going to get this main part. It has so many lines, which at that point, I don't think I was able, you know, didn't think I could do. But I just really wanted to sing. It was like a musical play. And she gave me the part. I don't even know how I was given the part, but she gave me the part and it completely changed the trajectory, I think, of how I saw myself and how I participated at school. And since then I was back on track to being my active, like expressive self. And so I really, really appreciate that she was able to see that in me, this like girl that was like just dying to express herself, but couldn't. And so, yeah, I feel like, yeah, huge shout out to Ms. McGrory.
that's an awesome story. That's so cool too, though. I mean, that second grade, so we're talking about 30 years ago, right? And you still remember that concretely.
Yes. Oh yeah, no, and once I was given that part, I just remember being on this bus, the public bus, and just reading my line over and over and over and over.
Well, someone in education is definitely encouraging to hear, because sometimes, you know, you talk to people and they act like nothing happened before high school, you know, like, or, you know, before they went to college. And it's kind of like sometimes disheartening because I teach high school, you know, but it shows that some students do remember, right? Even 30 years later, if you
leave on
them. So my last question of the day is, or this interview, is what is coming up in your life in the next few years, next few decades? Well, you know, how do you foresee things?
Yes. And so I've done, you know, I'm part of this, you know, IDEO and design thinking, and, you know, we do human-centered design, but currently I'm passionate about kind of expanding our definition of human-centered design. You know, we design around people's desirabilities, but individuals don't really know what's good for themselves sometimes, and we've designed things that, you know, are like put burden on the environment and on society. So I'm kind of shifting towards more life-centered design, so, you know, continuing to design but within a defined space. There's certain sustainability principles that that we should stay within. and that's sort of like the safe space to design and innovate. And so, yeah, just add, like doing the same thing, but kind of adding considerations for how we can be sustainable or actually, yeah. And sustainability, I guess, right now is just kind of like plus minus zero. We're like sustaining. Ideally, we're getting to regeneration and, you know, creating more, you know, making things better than what it is today. So that type of design is what I hope to get involved with, and I'm really excited about doing it with enterprises because I feel like they can have such a huge impact. You know, like companies like you know, Unilever or P&G or, you know, Google, Microsoft, they have they control so much in their supply chain, and just tweaking some, you know, their design or how they design their ecosystem can have such a huge impact. So you know, rather than working through governments, I'm really excited to work through enterprises and see how we can create better, more regenerative and distributive design.
It's pretty cool. So you're saving the world is your plan. And it was great connecting with you today, and hopefully our paths will cross again in the future. And thank you for being on this episode of Tokyo Alumni Podcast. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm usually, you know, as a researcher, I'm usually sitting on the other side doing the interview. So it's, it feels strange to be on the other side, but also remind, you know, it helps you think of things that you reflect on things that you usually wouldn't on your own. So thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you very much.